proceedings. We'll now hear argument in cause number 86594, National Labor Relations Board versus United Food and Commercial Workers Union. Mr. Combe, you may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This case presents two questions. One, whether the withdrawal of an unfair labor practice complaint by the General Counsel of the National Labor Relations Board pursuant to an informal settlement entered into prior to the commencement of a hearing on the complaint constitutes agency action that is subject to judicial review. And the second question is whether, assuming that the GC's action is subject to judicial review, the General Counsel must hold an evidentiary hearing whenever the party who filed the unfair labor practice charge objects to the settlement agreement. Now, before addressing these questions, I should like to spend a few minutes outlining the statutory scheme and the board's procedures for implementing it, because I think it's important to understanding the resolution of the question. The National Labor Relations Board confers upon the National Labor Relations Board authority to prevent any person from engaging in an unfair labor practice affecting commerce. And it sets forth in general terms the procedure to be followed in determining whether an employer or a union has engaged in an unfair labor practice and the appropriate order therefore. However, Section 3D of the National Labor Relations Act provides that the Board's General Counsel, who is a statutory officer appointed by the President with the consent of the Senate, shall have final authority on behalf of the Board in respect to the investigation of unfair labor practice charges and the issuance of complaints in respect of the prosecution of such complaints before the Board. Now, the procedure that the Board has devised attempts to effectuate this separation that 3D makes between the Board's prosecutory authority on the one hand and its adjudicatory authority on the other. An unfair labor practice charge, case is initiated by the filing of a charge. It's investigated by the regional director, and if the investigation indicates the charge has merits, any person may file a charge. In this case, it was filed by the Food and Commercial Workers Union.
You mean just any person in the United States?
Yes, Your Honor.
Whether he's an employer or an employee or anything?
That is correct. Usually the charges are filed by an employer or an employee or the union.
Well, this particular case is one between two unions, isn't it?
Between two unions and an employer. If the investigation reveals that the charge does not have merit, it's either withdrawn or dismissed, in which case the charging party has an appeal to the Board's General Counsel. If the regional director concludes that it has merit, he affords an opportunity for a settlement of the charge. At this stage of the proceeding, the settlement is usually what is called an informal settlement, which does not require the entry of a board order or a court decree. It consists of a commitment by the charge party to take the agreed-upon remedial action And the case is closed upon compliance with that commitment. If later there's a failure to comply, the charge, the prosecution of the charge, can be resumed. Now, if no settlement is reached at this stage, a complaint issues. And if the complaint goes to hearing...
Does the regional director decide that the complaint shall issue?
The regional director does. He's acting as the agent of the general counsel at...
He's not the board's representative.
No, he's not the board's representative. The statute, as I indicated, gives the regional director final authority over the investigation of unfair labor practice charges. The statute also gives the general counsel supervision over the employees in the regional offices. And when the regional director is working on the unfair labor practice phase of the proceeding, he is exercising the general counsel's 3D authority. When he's working on representation cases, which lead to elections, he's also working under the supervision of the general counsel, but there the general counsel has been delegated by the board the authority to handle representation, supervise the handling of representation cases. But with respect to the complaint phase, the regional director is acting as the agent of the general counsel. Surprisingly, these things over time have been kept straight, although it may seem difficult to conceive of it. But if a settlement cannot be reached, as I indicated, the case... Yes, Your Honor.
There's something in the way of a case. He may try then to effect settlement. Is that
yes,
it?
Your Honor.
But suppose the party doesn't want to engage in any settlement discussions. Does he have an appeal?
At that point, he issues a complaint.
Oh, the regional director issues a complaint.
He issues a complaint.
And the party against whom it's issued has no appeal to the general counsel before he has to answer the complaint, does he?
Not normally. I mean, the procedure on appeal is usually invoked where a charge is dismissed. But, as I say, after a complaint issues, it may go to formal hearing, but there's usually a 2 to 3 month period between the issuance of the complaint and the formal hearing. And during that time, there is further opportunity for a settlement of the case. Or the complaint may be withdrawn because the regional director, in preparing for trial, finds that his evidence just won't stand up. Now, under the board's rules, the regional director can withdraw a complaint prior to hearing on his own motion. This is a provision that's been in the rules even way back to the Wagner Act days. Similarly, as I said, he can enter into a settlement agreement. At this stage, the post-complaint stage, the settlement agreements can be of two forms. You can have a formal settlement, which provides for a board order and often a consent decree. And that goes on up to the board because it requires a board order and board approval.
The these settlements are provided for or by regulation, aren't they?
Yes, they are, Your Honor.
And both the formal and the informal?
Yes, Your Honor. We have set forth at the appendix to our brief the board's regulations with respect to the settlement procedure.
Does it indicate how old those regulations are?
Those regulations were promulgated many years ago. In general form, they were in the Act from right after the start of Taft-Hartley, and then about 22 years ago, they got amplified. But essentially, this procedure has been a long-standing procedure that was worked out by the board and the general counsel right after the enactment of Taft-Hartley in an effort to make 3D mesh with the board's adjudicatory procedures.
That shows something of the ambivalence of the whole scheme, though, doesn't it? You said that the board's regulations permit the regional director to dismiss the complaint before any action is taken. Yet you told us earlier that the regional director was not the agent of the board, but the agent of the general counsel. If that were purely the case, one would expect the general counsel to issue some regulations as to what his regional directors can do.
Well, for housekeeping purposes, Congress decided instead of setting up a separate administrator to put the general counsel in the same agency as the board. And the way these regulations work out, or have worked out, is that although they're issued in the name of the board, those having to do with the operation of the general counsel's phase of the administration are worked out jointly with the board and the general counsel. There is a joint committee that has worked on these regulations. What would happen if you got to a point where you couldn't have agreement is an interesting question, but that has not fortunately been the case. Now, what we have here is not a formal settlement, but an informal settlement that was worked out post-complaint.
Where there's a formal settlement, any order of the board is subject to judicial review, is it?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And the question we have here is whether there's an informal settlement. Is it subject to judicial
yes,
review?
Yes, an informal settlement.
Do we have any other issue to decide in this case?
If only if you decide that it is subject to judicial review, would you have to reach the second question as to whether or not a charging party who objects to the settlement is entitled to an evidentiary hearing on its objections, because that is what the Third Circuit held, and the remand is for the board to hold such an evidentiary hearing.
Mr. Combe, if the case had proceeded far enough to have a hearing, at that point, is there any authority to settle the case and dismiss it on the part of the general counsel alone?
The general counsel cannot do that unilaterally. Once it goes to hearing, the adjudicatory process is invoked, and the withdrawal of the complaint or any settlement agreement that's entered into would have to be with the approval of the administrative law judge, and an appeal lies from that to the board. So that what we're really talking about here is a very narrow time span, as it were. The period after issuance of the complaint and prior to the opening of the hearing.
What's the difference, Mr. Grimm, between a formal settlement and an informal settlement?
The difference is that a formal settlement leads to a board order that is enforceable in the Court of Appeals. And so that if there is noncompliance with that order, the board can either proceed to get it enforced on consent, or if there was a consent also to a court decree, move for contempt of the order. With respect to an informal settlement, the only consequence is that the prosecution of the case is stopped. That is correct. And if there's compliance with the commitment, the case is closed on compliance, but should subsequently it appear that there is not compliance, then the settlement is withdrawn and the general counsel is free to resume the prosecution of the case.
Suppose the general counsel changes his mind after one of these informal settlements. There hasn't been any violation of the informal settlement by the party with whom it's made. But the general counsel just decides it was a bad idea. Would anything prevent him from going ahead to reinstitute the complaint?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor, because he acts in the public interest here, and there's no estoppel, as it were, that that would operate against him. But
has it ever happened, to your knowledge, that without a violation of the informal consent agreement, the general counsel just decides?
I wouldn't say never, but if it's ever happened, it's so rare that
you don't personally know that it's ever happened.
No, I mean these settlements play a very key role in the administration of the act. The board settles over 92% of its cases. And as the Attorney General's committee pointed out in its seminal study back in 1941, it's the lifeblood of the administrative process. And so that...
Mr. Combe, doesn't that 92% figure cover settlements pre-complaint?
There's a substantial number pre-complaint.
Are there very many of these post-complaint?
Yes, there are. There are about 35%, according to the 83 statistics that we have in our brief, of which most of those are post-complaint informal settlements. The reason for that is that experience has shown that many times parties are not going to settle a case until you get them on the courthouse steps. And
let me ask one other question on the universe we're dealing with. How often in those settlements does the charging party seek review, as they did here? Fairly rare, isn't it?
We have not had many cases. However, that is not to say that if it were established by this court that there is a right to review, and that
Well, there's been a right to review in the Sixth Circuit for 20 years without any cases, hasn't there?
Well, in the Third Circuit.
Third Circuit, I mean.
In the Third Circuit.
They had 20 years, they had this rule, and nobody ever used it for 20 years, isn't that right?
But as I say, the potential would be there, and human nature being what it is not unreasonable to expect that if there were not only the right to review, but also the right to a board review, as my brother here is urging, that a party for tactical reasons would play out the string here. And this isn't just a labor versus management kind of issue, because the employer can be in the role of the objecting party, as can the union. And experience has shown that in order to resolve most effectively labor management disputes, it's better to get things resolved quickly and with some degree of certainty, and that if you tack on review to an informal settlement, there would be a strong disincentive to settle, because one of the reasons for settling is to avoid the cost and also the risk of litigation.
Well, Mr. Dolan, of the 92% of the cases settled, how many are, what proportion are informal and what proportion formal settlements?
I would say that the vast majority are informal settlements. And of those...
When you say vast, is that half of the 92% or three-quarters or what?
Well, in the 1983 statistics, which we have in our brief, the formal settlements were about 0.6% of the total number of settlements. So when the informals are really the bulk of the settlements, and of those, about 65% occur before a complaint, and you've got about 35% of the remainder.
But in either event, neither is subject to judicial review, is it? Pre or post?
That is correct, with the possible exception that a informal that is entered into after hearing, where you have to get the approval of the administrative law judge and the board. There have been two such cases in the Seventh Circuit, and those have been reviewed.
But as between formal and informal settlements after complaint issues, right? What it's roughly 35% of the total universe is informal, and 0.6% is formal.
The 0.6%. That's about right, Your Honor. Those statistics are set forth in Table 7 of the 1983 annual report, which is cited in our brief, the most recent report that has been published. But currently, the mix is not too dissimilar.
Mr. Combe, I don't understand what you just said. You said that some informal complaints do require the approval of the board? You still consider it an informal complaint if it's entered after the hearing begins and requires the approval of the ALJ and also the approval of the board? You still consider that an informal settlement?
Yes, because it hasn't resulted in a board order in the conventional sense that.
Why isn't the approval of the board a board order? That it might well be a board order as far as the Administrative Procedure Act is concerned.
Well, I think that it is, and that's why those have been reviewed.
But you say it just doesn't result in any command by the board, the violation of which.
That is correct, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Very well, Mr. Kahn. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Gold.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, as Mr. Kahn has indicated, the issue here is the reviewability of the settlement that was made over the opposition of the union, which was the charging party, the Food and Commercial Workers Union. The same issue would be presented whether the charging party were a union or an employer. The system works the same way whomever has filed the charge. It's our view that what Congress intended in 1947 was to provide that settlements that are entered into post-complaint are to be presented to the board itself, and that the requirement is across the board whether or not the settlement is labeled informal or formal.
Well, Mr. Gold, the statute certainly doesn't expressly make that clear.
Now,
is this not a case where some deference to the interpretation of the statute by the agency is due?
In this instance, Your Honor, we do think that the statute pushes very hard in the direction of the position we take, and that this is what the understanding was at the time. It's very difficult to understand exactly how it is that the board has come to the conclusions it has. Originally, right after the enactment of Taft-Hartley, the position we urged was a position that was followed by the board. 1 year later, without any explanation, the board changed its view. And that's
it's been consistent since then.
Yes, it has been consistent since then. But
do you think that's an unreasonable interpretation of this language of the statute?
I think that it's an interpretation of the statute which cuts very deeply against the statutory provisions, and moreover, as the discussion thus far has indicated, it is an interpretation of the statute which has resulted in a number of lines being drawn, none of which seems to have much in the way of logic. First of all, there's a line between an informal settlement and a formal settlement. But an informal settlement is what the general counsel says it is, and a formal settlement is what the general counsel says that is. Formal settlements do not necessarily create any enforceable rights in court. So that's line number one, which this system creates. Line number two is that.
Excuse me, why do you, I don't follow that. I thought that the general counsel calls a formal settlement only something that results in a board order in the sense of a command to the parties. and that he considers those board orders that merely approve the dismissal of the complaint to be not formal settlements but informal settlements.
It's
not a question of terminology, but I understand his use of terminology to be as I've just described it.
That isn't the way it works. There are really three kinds of settlements. There are informal settlements with the general, which the general counsel enters into on his or her own hook. There are formal settlements that don't provide for court enforcement, which are presented to the board, and it result in a board order. And then
he calls them informal settlements, I think.
They
do not produce a board order.
They produce a board order, it would seem to me, in the sense that under 10F, it's certainly an order of the board, and nobody would protest that it's not reviewable. On the other hand, the order does not provide for court enforcement if there's backsliding by the respondent. And then
you call those formal settlements, and you think he calls them that, too.
Yeah, that is my understanding. But at any rate, then there is another kind of settlement, a settlement in which the board demands that you consent to court enforcement in a contempt-like action, as if you had been through the whole proceeding. And all I am saying is that this system, which has grown like Topsy, divides these up according more or less, at least between informal settlement kind number one and informal settlement kind number two, according to the general counsel's whim. Next, there is the rule that if the matter goes to hearing, then there has to be the kind of presentment to the board which we think Congress intended for all post-complaint cases. Thus, insofar as this is an administrative system which has grown up without much scrutiny, without much judicial consideration, and relatively little board consideration, it was neither the original understanding nor is it an understanding.
Mr. Gold, is anything judicially reviewable that does not involve a board order?
As we read 10E and 10F, you need a board order.
Yes.
Well,
then, if that's so, and these informal settlements, is there any board order?
The language of the statute...
is there?
We think so.
And what is it?
The language of the statute says that orders of the board are reviewable in court, or at least certain kinds of orders of the board are reviewable in court. It also says under Section 3D that the general counsel acts on behalf of the board. We don't believe, for example, if the general counsel entered into something called a formal settlement and didn't use the right processes, we think that that would be reviewable in court. We don't think that this kind of...
There exists no formal board order.
Yeah, but a general counsel order having all the substance of the board order, we believe, is judicially reviewable under 10E and 10F because...
Mr. Gold, if you were right in your interpretation, then presumably even an order withdrawing, deciding not to file a complaint in the first instance would be a final order.
No, I don't believe
that... I just think your logic would carry you to a very peculiar place. Every action that the general counsel takes is automatically a final order of the board by your reading of the statute, then even his decision not to file a complaint would be reviewable.
No, we don't think that that's what the statute says, Your Honor. If I could, Section 10F says that any person aggrieved by a final order of the board granting or denying in whole or in part the relief sought may obtain a review of such order in any circuit court of appeals. The understanding of that language before...
But if you apply the APA to this, under your reading of Section 153D, anything the general counsel did becomes a final order of the board.
There's an exception in the APA for matters left to agency discretion. My point about 10E and 10F and the understanding pre-47 as well as post-47 is that the reference to a final order of the board granting or denying in whole or in part the relief sought is the relief sought in the complaint, not the relief that the individual comes to the agency and asks to be embodied in a complaint. The request of somebody to have a complaint issued and the refusal to do so was not reviewable prior to 1947, and we don't believe is reviewable now. The language was the same in this instance, pre-47 and post-47. So we think that the logic of the statute, both before 1947 and after, is that there is a line that Congress drew. There are informal proceedings in which the individual comes to the agency, says, I have a charge of a violation which has merit. Please create a formal proceeding by issuing a complaint. And the situation after the complaint issues, in which there is a formal proceeding. We think that those formal proceedings, as is true in a variety of formal proceedings, were intended to be terminated only with the approval of the adjudicatory agency. In other words, we think that the filing of the complaint, and that we believe that this was Congress's understanding, it's clear understanding, that the filing of the complaint was like the filing of a complaint in court and an answer, after which you can only withdraw the case with judicial approval, or the filing criminal case in court, which reaches a certain procedure, which again can only be settled or withdrawn with the approval of the tribunal.
Mr. Gold, if you take the language of 10F literally, the review should be directly in the Court of Appeals.
Yes, and that is what we did here.
You would, and that's, and why? Where then does the authority for the evidentiary hearing come?
Well, we had. We're making a procedural complaint, so it is that we did not get the procedure we were due in the agency. I take it.
So that your position, I just have it clear, is that if a general counsel dismisses a complaint, they say it's not reviewable before the board, you say that your remedy is to go directly to the Court of Appeals.
Yeah. We are saying that whether the general counsel issues something called an order finding the respondent in violation without going through the procedures, and a respondent says, wait a minute, seeks review of that, or whether the general counsel goes the other way, that where there's a settlement issue, that the procedure we are due under the statute is a hearing on the settlement if there is an amicable agreement in this three-party
A hearing before whom?
Lawsuit. A hearing before an administrative law judge and the board. In other words, that we...
But you don't say that hearing is commanded by 10F.
No. No, we're saying that the nature...
statutory provision commands that hearing.
Right. Seems to us that 10A and 10B demand that. There's an internal system for handling complaints, and we're saying that part of that internal system within the agency for handling complaints is that once the complaint issues, the statute contemplates that the board will determine what happens to the case. And the board has all the options as an agency that any other agency has or that a court has.
Well, supposing that's true, what issues are there in the evidentiary hearing that you say you have a right to? Is that just what the charging party wants to litigate?
Yeah, it would be the, in our view, it is the same kind of hearing that a district court would conduct.
Well, a district court ordinarily doesn't conduct any hearing if the parties stipulate to a settlement.
Well, but here one party doesn't. Obviously, if all the parties stipulate to the settlement, it's like a summary judgment case. The proposition that there has to be a hearing doesn't make any sense. But here, a party, namely the charging party, doesn't agree, and that's why.
So what then are the issues?
The issues are it would seem to us the same kind of issues that a district court has.
Okay, what are those issues?
Whether it is fit and proper for the settlement to be entered into, whether it carries out the intent of the act, whether there have been irregularities.
It's a review of the general counsel's exercise of his discretion.
The only reason I'm afraid of that statement, Chief Justice, is that it says, you said his discretion. We don't believe that in that regard he has a discretion any more or that he has an unfettered discretion. Let me put it that way. Obviously, there is a discretion in that the general counsel's views are going to weigh very heavily with the hearer, just the way the prosecutor's views or the plaintiff's views are going to weigh very heavily with a court in an analogous case.
You said here one of the parties hasn't agreed to the settlement. Did the charging party isn't necessarily or automatically a party to the complaint hearing? Doesn't he have to be given an order to intervene?
The statute and the rules contemplate that the charging party is a party
even
to
even without
the
a special order of intervention? Yes. He's automatically a party, I see.
Mr. Gold, I'd like to ask a question. It relates to Justice Stevens' question earlier about whether this belongs in the district court or the court of appeals. You're reading 10F. Any person aggrieved by a final order of the board, as meaning any order of the board, any final order of the board.
Any order finally disposing of a complaint.
Finally disposing of a complaint.
Yeah. In other words, we don't, prior to 1947, and correctly in our judgment, the actions of the agency, when it was a unitary agency, with regard to whether a complaint was issued, has never been regarded as reviewable. We think that the intent of 10F was correctly captured in those decisions.
Well, I don't see it. That's sort of a middle ground. I can see how 10F might be read to mean any order whatever, which would produce a very strange result. You'd have review in the Court of Appeals where there's no record below. So you would really want to use the usual district court review rather than court of appeals. That's one extreme. It seems to me that the alternative to that is regarding 10F as referring to the order described in 10C, which is very clear. It says in 10C that after a complaint's filed, if upon the preponderance of the testimony, the board shall be of the opinion that any person named has engaged or
yes.
is engaging in an unfair labor practice, the board shall state its findings of fact and shall issue and cause to be served on such person an order in one direction or the other. That's the order, it seems to me, that 10F refers to. And that is not the kind of order at issue here.
Well, it's partially the kind of order because you have in part, it is that kind of order, and what we're struggling with is what happens in this class of case. So the defendant comes in and says, "I am prepared not to fight on issues 1, 2, 3, and 4 if you enter an order which is doesn't carry any court consequence.
But 10C only says an order requiring such person to cease and desist from such unfair labor practice. That's the kind of order it's referring to.
Well, the order...
This whole section is entitled Prevention of Unfair Labor Practices. It sets forth a whole structure. In C, it says what kind of an order the board shall issue. And then in F, it says any person aggrieved by an order of the board. It seems to me it's obviously referring to the same order that's described in C.
In those terms, an order... There's more of 10C. An order saying that there is no unfair labor practice... wouldn't be reviewable. But obviously both 10C and the logic of the situation indicate that an order saying that there's a violation, an order saying that there's not a violation, are reviewable. Now, what about an order saying that the respondent will consent to an order which is not review, which doesn't carry a contempt sanction, saying that he will not do certain things which would be an unfair labor practice. And the individual who brought the charge and who has a recognized status says that's not enough.
It may be reviewable, but not under 10F.
Well,
if it's
we
reviewable,
argued too
it'd
that
be under the APA, yes, which means it would go into district court, which is where it should be if there hasn't been any formal proceeding. You need a record to be made.
Perhaps it's where it should be if you're fighting about the substance of the settlement. But if the claim is that the general counsel has run around the procedure entirely so and has taken an action which is in reality an action which we believe is an action which can only be taken by the board, it seemed to us that the logic of the situation was that kind of law question went as well and as sensibly to the Court of Appeals. We argue, as an alternative, that the APA gives us a right to test this question of whether Congress intended that the board must be given an opportunity to pass on these proposed settlements. If that argument is right, then it would lead to, at least in the future, review in the district courts rather than under 10F. And we certainly think for the reasons we give that a total failure of an agency to follow the procedure contemplated in the statute ought to lead to APA review, and that it's senseless to send us back to the district court.
Mr. Gold, if the government is right, I take it that the board itself could not prohibit the general counsel from entering into informal settlements.
That's right. I mean, unless the government's position here is that they can do whatever they want, it seems to me that where we actually are is that the general counsel has the trump card. If he enters into...
And why shouldn't that be the same trump card if the proceeding has started? I mean, if the hearing has started.
That's what's a total mystery to us, and it may be that if you rule for the board here, the board will greatly regret having joined hands with the general counsel as well as...
Mr. Gold, take the stage of the proceeding where the general counsel issued a complaint, but the charged party has issued no response.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you say a settlement, even at that stage, requires you're entitled to a hearing and is reviewable. Now, that's not like your district court proceeding at all, it seems to me. That's where the plaintiff has filed a complaint. The defendant hasn't filed an answer. And that's dismissible at the will of the plaintiff in the district
court. That is the rule in the district court. But our argument here is that the statute draws a different line. Obviously, it could draw that line.
But your argument before that you had the same kind of hearing that a district court would have, I thought you meant that the proceedings were analogous. They're really not analogous.
I'm saying that the issues to be presented to the tribunal in this kind of a three-party situation are analogous to the issues on whether or not to approve a settlement in a normal district court case brought by a plaintiff after answer, in a class action case brought after the class is certified, which is very close because that, too, is one where you have a representative rather than just one party on the plaintiff's side.
And though those district court case examples have gone considerably further than just the filing of a complaint, which is all we have here.
That's true, but it is also true that the mere filing of a complaint is a less painstaking process than in a civil case than the filing of a complaint by this public agency after quite an elaborate system for trying to separate the wheat and the chaff. I want to take advantage of the rest of my time to emphasize the following point. In 1947, the general understanding, and indeed we, while there are quibbles from the board, we think that the only possible understanding from the written materials was that the board itself passed on settlements post-complaint. Formal or informal or whatever. And that the overall thrust of the 1947 amendments were to provide a higher level of procedures, open procedures by disinterested decision makers and less staff determination than had been true prior to 1947. We believe it turns the statute absolutely upside down to say that one piece of Congress's effort to reach a higher due process stage in the adjudication of unfair labor practice cases, namely the creation of an independent general counsel, worked without anybody saying so to limit the right of the charging party to get either an administrative law judge or, if you go to that point, the board's determination, a more disinterested determination, on whether the settlement really effectuates the policies of the Act and protects the interests.
Mr. Gold, weren't the due process concerns that motivated Taft-Hartley weren't basically concerns about fairness to the charging party, were they?
Oh, I think they were, Your Honor, because as the Court has remarked in other circumstances, what was sauce for the goose became sauce for the gander because Taft-Hartley, for the first time, created charging party rights in employers against unions. And Senator Taft and his colleagues were very solicitous of the rights and interests of that new class of charging parties. Certainly there was nothing that anybody said or anything that was indicated which would cut back into that. The reason for creating a general counsel was to keep the board out of something that was considered not to be a proper adjudicatory function, namely the issuance of complaints, the determination to go forward. But it is a proper adjudicatory function, as we've indicated, has always been understood to be such for the tribunal before whom the proceeding is pending at a certain stage to say whether or not a settlement should be accepted.
So you think they've just been making a mistake for 30 years, 40 years?
It's been a mistake which...
This practice has been going on for a long time.
But without judicial approval, the D.C. Circuit and the Third Circuit have said this is wrong, and the board just has continued to chug along as if that hasn't happened. So the situation is one, because I don't think there are that many charging parties who will relish the proposition of challenging their champion's determination. The situation is one in which there hasn't been sufficient motive. But as I say, before 47, what we're saying is Congress's intent was, so far as everything shows, the practice. From 47 to 40.
That practice was a board-created practice.
Yes.
And what you're arguing here is that somehow Congress intended to freeze that practice. And the only thing you can point to as being a freezing of that practice is 10F, right?
No, 10. I think that practice was one which the agency created, but which was one which the statute has always intended, because it seems to us that Section 10B, which has always been there, contemplates that once the complaint issues, the matter will be determined by the board.
Yep, so what I'm saying is, if I don't read 10F as applying to this kind of an order, the only thing that applies to this order is the Administrative Procedure Act, and there's no intent there to freeze the agency into a particular administrative scheme that existed in 1947.
I guess the way we view this case, Justice Scalia, there are two aspects to the judicial review question. Aspect number one is, what did Congress intend with regard to the procedures within the agency? And then question number two, which we think depends on the resolution of question number one, is, if the agency doesn't proceed in that way, does the party disadvantaged have a right to have a court say that you have followed an improper procedure?
Thank you, Mr. Gold. Your time has expired. Mr. Cum, do you have anything in rebuttal? You have 5 minutes.
Just a couple of points, Your Honor. In the first place, Congress's basic intention in enacting 3D was to separate the board's prosecutory authority from its adjudicatory authority. At the time of the 47 amendments, the board had delegated some of its prosecutorial authority, but it had retained some aspects of it. We submitted it is clearly unreasonable to conclude that Congress intended to freeze the situation, which would have left prosecutorial authority that the board was continuing to exercise still with the board. So the point that Congress intended to freeze the situation pre-47 just doesn't stand up.
Well, Mr. Cum, could the board require informal settlements by the general counsel to be reviewed by the board?
Not, we believe, certainly prior to the issuance of the complaint. And
well, what about in this very case?
Post-complaint, I think that the board could not go back to the point of the issuance of the complaint without doing violence to 3D, because 3D talks about the general counsel's final authority extending not only to the investigation of charges and the issuance of complaints, but with respect to the prosecution of such complaints before the board. So you have to allow some room post-complaint for the general counsel's final authority to operate.
And we answer is no, the board could not require him to get the approval of the board for informal settlements after the complaint is issued.
At least up until before the hearing opens.
Well, why wouldn't that same rule apply to post-hearing while the hearing is going on? What if the general counsel wants to settle?
Well,
I take it you agree then that the board has to agree.
At that point, I think that the adjudicatory process has commenced, and that the board, as the adjudicator, has the inherent authority of all adjudicatory bodies to regulate the order of proceedings once the adjudicatory phase has opened. And barring any restriction in the statute, which there is none here, the board was reasonable in drawing the line at the opening of the hearing. Now, my last point is that with respect to...
You mean the board and the general counsel was reasonable?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Just to settle terminology, do you consider that a formal settlement or an informal settlement? Where the board, all the board approves is a dismissal of the complaint with no order from the board.
I would regard that as a informal settlement. That the formal settlement requires a board order that requires the party to do something. Now, whether that order provides for enforcement by a court of appeals or not does not deprive it of being a formal settlement, because the parties have consented to the order, the board can go into the court of appeals and get automatic enforcement of that order, because under 10E, respondent has waived his right to contest the order, and we have done that. My last point is that we read 10F the way you have suggested, Judge Scalia, as the type of order that is referred to is a 10C order. And that is made even plainer when you look at 10E, which is the provision for the board going for enforcement.
Mr. Kumm, your time has expired.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. We'll hear argument.